You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In his book, The Zeros, My Misadventures in the Decade Wall Street Went Insane, Randall Lane describes how, by starting a media company that published magazines aimed at traders and dealmakers, he became a Wall Street insider himself. From that vantage point, Mr. Lane was able to both witness and help perpetuate the culture of wealth and power that contributed to the financial crash of 2008. His book is full of vivid anecdotes that describe the greed and excess that surrounded him, and it is published by Portfolio, a Penguin imprint. I'm very pleased to welcome Randall Lane, who's currently editor-at-large at The Daily Beast, to our show today. Hi.
Hey. Glad to be here. Thank you.
Now, you refer to the past decade as the zeros. I haven't seen that before.
It's a journalistic problem in that nobody's figured out what to call these last 10 years. And just kind of looking back, it's the only decade for 1,000 years where there are two zeros in the middle. It's a once-in-a-millennium quirk. Mm-hmm. But then from my vantage point, I mean, I spent the whole decade kind of counting, you know, keeping score on Wall Street, and the zeros – we were counting. I mean, we were doing 7, 8, 9, 10 digits a year, not net worth, but that's what people were making. But then if you really look back kind of from a kind of historical, a step back perspective, there was zero net worth appreciation over the course of between 2000 and 2009, zero stock market appreciation, zero median net income appreciation. And the people that we were dealing with in retrospect, were there were a lot of zeros there. So it seems to be a... for lack of a, you know, for a decade looking for a name, it struck me as something that, fit very well.
Well, you're the Washington bureau chief at Forbes. Weren't you aware that there were some zeros in the business?
I was aware of some zeros, but I did not know to the extent that there was maybe a majority zero effect.
Wasn't it a bit risky when you left Forbes to start your own company?
Risky, but fun. I mean, especially when you're at Forbes and you're chronicling entrepreneurs. And, you know, Forbes is really a business about people who take risks and start companies. It's very hard at some point not to say, well, you know, I'd like to give that a shot. And instead of sitting on the sidelines, maybe get into the fray a little, but do it through something I understood, which was journalism.
And also chronicling, giving profiles to the entrepreneurs, or in this case, to the people on Wall Street.
Correct. And what we were setting out to do, and my initial partner was a very successful trader, and he was pointing out that especially, I mean, think about trading, especially here in New York. It's always been about the physical pits. I mean, there's a reason that every joke before the internet age, you know, when you get a call back in the 90s or something, it started on a trading floor. It was an incredible viral community. And that's because you had 2,000, 3,000 men, and they were men, there were almost no women, in like a rugby scrum in little rooms, shoulder to shoulder, dealing with huge sums of money. So it was really a community. And what happened around the turn of the century, around 2000, was you had that kind of blow up where electronic trading, as they call it in the business, but it's really computerized trading, became the norm, and everybody started trading in little pods of 1, 10, 100, but you didn't have that community of 1,000, 2,000 people. That's what this magazine and these magazines and websites we started were meant to do, is replicate that community.
Even the kinds of people who were doing the trading changed, didn't they?
That's right.
They had been kind of the jocks of the business,
right,
for a long time, and no longer after we went computer digital.
It was revenge of the nerds for the last 10 years, where instead of, if you think about the physical pits, what are the advantages? It's size, it's being able to shout the loudest, it's instincts. These are a lot of things that there was a reason that jocks gravitated to trading. It made sense. But in electronic trading, it's all about algorithms, analyzing numbers. And so we had a complete flip in the culture of trading over the last 10 years.
You mentioned your first partner. His name was Magnus Greaves.
Yes.
It sounds like something out of a Dickens novel.
And he looks like a Magnus Greaves. He's about 6'4" and about 300 pounds. So he's somebody who grew into a very kind of lofty name, and he fit the bill.
How did you meet him?
He called. He'd heard about me. I'd started a magazine before this company, called POV, which was a men's business magazine. And he had this kind of inkling of idea of doing a kind of a business magazine. And he called me to consult for him. And after a few months or even a year of consulting, I finally said, you know, Magnus, instead of me kind of helping you develop a business plan that you would sell to somebody else, why don't we start a media company together? And so we did.
Well, the name is a clue as to what you had in mind. You called it Double Down Media. Sounds rather risky.
Yes, the irony is thick.
You play blackjack?
It was meant on a blackjack term. And that's really from my experience. When I started POV, it was a single magazine. And we went through, we had a lot of success. We were Adweek Startup of the Year. We were on Adweek's hot list. But we wound up going out of business after tearing through $18 million. And it's because in media, it's very hard to make it work without critical mass. And so the idea of this new company was Double Down. Double Down, as anybody who plays blackjack knows, is a smart bet. It's riskier, but it's smart when the cards are right, in that you put more money on the table, but your odds are better. And that was exactly the reason we named the company that.
We had a wife and a couple of young kids. Were you putting your own money on the table?
At first, I was not. I was putting sweat equity in. But then as the company went on, as the tale of too many entrepreneurs I followed, there were payrolls that had to be met sometimes where we didn't have the money, and I started just raiding my entire life savings to put into the company.
It's often been pointed out that Wall Street and gambling have something in common. I knew someone who used to be a personal banker to Wall Streeters who'd made millions of dollars a year, and yet they'd have to advance them some money to pay off their gambling losses.
Sure. Well, it's the same mentality. What you see, especially over the last 10 years, over the zeros, was that you detached the idea of work and money. When you work on Wall Street, like for most people, almost everybody listening here, money equals time. You work a week, you get a paycheck. You work 2 weeks, you get a paycheck. You get paid by the hour, the year, whatever it is. On Wall Street, there's no connection between time and money. One good or smart or lucky trade can make you $1 million or even $1 billion. And so they have that gambler's mentality. You make it, you spend it, and you make some more, because it's not time, work and money are detached.
But also for the bank, it was a sure thing to advance the money because they knew he was going to get his bonus anyway.
Sure.
And that is not a risk. So, which was kind of interesting. The bankers weren't taking any risk there. You tell the story about running into John McCain in a casino.
If there was ever a metaphor for the entire decade, it's me bumping into John McCain at a craps table at a media conference. And he was a keynote speaker. And this is right when he was gearing up to run in 2008 for president. And so here's somebody who wants to curry favor with the media, kind of the media elite, and try to, you know, set up his presidential run. And what did he do? He spent at least 3 hours, because I came, he was already at the table when I came. I thought, wow, what an opportunity to you know, maybe play craps with a future president. I was with him for 3 hours rolling craps, and he was still there when I left at 1 a.m. I finally said, you know, I got work to do. I got to get some sleep. He was giving the morning speech, and he was still playing. What was interesting is I put my $100 down, and I was playing, and I was winning a little, losing a little, but generally up, the table was hot. He was playing, John McCain was playing with colored chips I'd never seen before. He was definitely putting out thousands of dollars on the table. And this is, you know, this is the person who wanted to be the leader of the free world. If there's not a, you know, an example of what the whole mindset of the decade was, I don't know what it is.
Well, he took a big gamble when he named Sarah Palin.
Sure,
that's his running mate.
That was his double down.
My guess is Randall Lane has written a book called The Zeros, My Misadventures in the Decade Wall Street Went Insane. So the idea behind this magazine that you were putting out with Magnus Greaves, Trader Monthly, mm-hmm. was to find a niche audience so that you didn't have to produce too many magazines, mm-hmm. but you were going to go after the people and the advertisers who would make sure that you weren't really taking a risk.
Right. We thought we had the ultimate media model, which is instead of – I mean the magazine model is fundamentally broken, as we've seen, especially over the last few years. But what we were going to do is just take the people that advertisers most want to reach, which is it was a pure audience. It was almost all male, which advertisers love. It's not necessarily, I don't think that's good for the world that trading's so male dominated, but it's a fact. So we had a very pure audience.
So a lot of
advertisers. A lot of cars and watches and booze, and as well as trading ads too. So it was a very pure elite audience, and we just sent it for free to anybody who could prove to us that they were a professional trader. And that gave us a very powerful database eventually.
And not just in the United States?
Correct. We had a London edition. We had a Dubai edition. We were working on a Brazil edition. We were talking to Russia. It really was a China, it really was a global phenomenon. That's something that was very interesting over the zeros, was that because the pits kind of blew up and because of electronic trading, it democratized trading, which is good in some ways, but also very dangerous and bad in a lot of ways.
As an outsider, would I have understood what the magazine was all about?
You would have understood the lifestyle and the culture, but in terms of the nitty-gritty, no. It was, they speak their own language, and that's the language. By having Magnus as my partner, we were able to have a very authentic voice. He looked over every story before we printed it, and we were able to speak the language of trading, and it is a foreign language. But you would have got a lot of the slogan of the magazine was "See it, make it, spend it." And again, in retrospect, it's absurd.
You could have called the magazine "Excess."
It was excess, but at the time, it felt completely normal. And that's kind of when, in writing this book and stepping back and looking at the craziness and the foolishness. And just reminding myself that at the time, all this seemed completely normal.
So how much circulation did you have for this book?
We had 100,000 readers, or we sent out 100,000 copies here in the U.S. We did 50,000 in the U.K., 10,000 in Dubai. And then we had a website that was password only that increased that number.
And was doing well. And
yes.
Then you came up with a second magazine, Dealbreaker.
Dealmaker, yes.
Dealmaker. What was that magazine's target audience?
Well, the bankers started coming to us.
I like Dealbreaker better.
Well, we wound up broke. But the bankers came to us and said, how come you have this magazine for traders? We'd like a magazine. So, you know, in terms of investment bankers, private equity, which a lot of people think of Wall Street as just one thing, it's a completely different animal, the investment banking, private equity side.
Now, how much of this is just stroking the people who you're sending the magazine to? You're saying, you know, if you really do well, we'll give you a profile and we'll talk about what you're involved in?
A lot of it. It's not as much an explicit quid pro quo, but the magazine became the place where you could crow about what you've done. And that was a sea change. And that was very surprising even to me, because when we started doing this, in the first couple issues, we started to have to grab anybody we knew who trusted us and say, trust us, this is going to be fun, people will notice this. But then we started getting flooded with people who wanted to be in the magazine. And that's different, because for decades, if you're on Wall Street, you know, loose lips sink ships. You did not talk about your strategies. You did not talk about how much you made. All that would get you was unwanted attention, whether it was from regulators, competitors, people wanted to steal your ideas. What happened during the zeros was that traders and Wall Street became like rock stars, and we were kind of the vehicle for them to show off and look like rock stars.
It was like commissioning a self-portrait.
Correct, which we did some of that too. So,
and you threw a lot of parties. Where were they held?
We had them at every fancy venue in most cities in the Western world. I mean, we eventually became, as our database grew, and with one email we could get 500, 300, 1,000 high net worth traders to show up in a room. The advertisers eventually said, yeah, we like the advertising pages, but we really want to meet these people and interact with them. So we became, in some ways, a party company that produced really, really nice magazines, as opposed to a magazine company had a few events.
Who's paying for the parties?
Sponsors. I mean, we'd pay for them, but then we would package it as part of the sponsorship. But we would have, I mean, probably our best known party, we had annual boxing matches where we rented out the Hammerstein Ballroom here in New York, which seats, you know, 1,000 people, you know, black tie, and we'd have traders boxing each other.
Where they'd pay to fight each other.
They would train.
I'd pay to have somebody else fight for me.
Even better, they would pay to watch their peers fight each other. They'd pay up to $1,000 ticket for a night of black tie boxing and steak and vodka and sitting in fancy cars and smoking fancy cigars. And again, if you took a picture of that room, you know, I think 50 years from now, people will look at those pictures and just shake their head. It was unbelievable.
Well, a lot of testosterone, obviously.
You
mentioned
of money.
That one of the parties occurred on September 16, 2008, the day that the feds took over AIG, the day after Lehman Brothers collapsed. Is that a good time to party?
Yeah, we had a big party at the Stone Rose, which is a very, very fancy bar in the Time Warner Center. That it had already been set, and so we had a decision whether to cancel it or not. And something very interesting happened on September 15th, you know, Black Monday, Lehman Brothers goes down. September 16th, AIG has to be bailed out. And something over those 2 days, the party RSVP line flooded we went from like a 500-person party to almost 1,000 people. And so we decided not to cancel the party because we thought, well, there's something going on here. The community wanted to be together. But what was different, at every party before then, for 4 years, people would be lining up to sit in the cars and sample the vodka and smoke the cigars, and nobody quite knew what to do at this party. And that was the day where something changed, where I looked around and said, well, we still have this amazing ability to convene this very interesting, influential audience, but there was something different where nobody quite knew how to act, because all of a sudden it was decidedly uncool to be flaunting your riches.
My guest is Randall Lane, who's editor-at-large at The Daily Beast. He's written a book called The Zeros, My Misadventures in the Decade Wall Street Went Insane. It's published by Portfolio. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Randall Lane, who had a number of magazines under... he was the editor-in-chief and CEO of Double Damn Media, founded and or relaunched six magazines, including Trader Monthly, Dealmaker, and Private Air. He's told a story of those experiences in a book called The Zeros, My Misadventures in the Decade Wall Street Went Insane. It's published by Portfolio. The first section of your book describes Wall Street on the upswing from 2001 to 2006, well before the collapse. What were some of the most excessive displays of wealth that you witnessed during that time?
Oof. We'd need a couple hours for that. But in terms of what was interesting was we did two things. We were the scorekeepers in that every year we did something for Trader Monthly called the Trader Monthly 100, where we would count how much money everyone made. And I came into this, I had a pretty good business journalism background, but there's a difference between business and Wall Street. And I don't think I fully understood that until starting on this adventure / misadventure.
You didn't see that at Forbes?
You saw it, but until you're really in the middle of it, you don't fully understand that people on Wall Street are not business people. They are closer to gamblers, at least right now, than they are to business people. They're not creating jobs or really creating anything except they're taking positions and they're pushing paper around for the most part.
How many of them are really young? You had a feature called 30 Under 30.
Sure, and that got huge, huge attention. I mean, we had hundreds of people try to nominate themselves for that list. It was because, especially these guys who grew up kind of in the YouTube, Facebook generation, the idea that here's this glory list appealed to people. But in terms of counting the riches, going to your question about that excess, seeing people making, I worked on the Forbes 400 for a year, so I counted. I was used to counting wealth. I was used to finding billionaires. That didn't jade me. But the idea that people can make $1 billion in 1 year, and we're not talking Bill Gates, Warren Buffett, like my stock appreciated. I mean, those are people who built very amazing companies, and then the stock goes up and down, and we all understand that. These are people who were taking risks, mostly with other people's money, happening to score a nice trade and taking $1 billion cash off the table. It was mind-boggling.
Well, people who don't make that kind of money often wonder how much you have to make before you're making enough to satisfy yourself.
Right.
And I get the sense that there is no amount that's too high, because this is really about scorekeeping.
That's right.
More than it's about making enough money to be able to pay the bills.
It's a game, and these people get addicted to it. And it's not about – I mean, right, you get to a certain point in life. I mean, if you're John Paulson or Stevie Cohen, these are people who, over the course of the zeros, made $5 or $10 billion cash, but they still keep on doing it. They're addicted to winning. I mean, it's a personality trait that draws these kind of people.
But you write that when Goldman Sachs issued the first ever $100 million bonus, its public relations department tried to prevent you from publishing news about that.
Well, their PR department and their legal department sent us a letter threatening to sue us if we printed that. We had a very, very good authority. We knew all, that they'd paid at least one trader a $100 million bonus. This is a publicly traded company, so they were very, very sensitive to that. But in some ways, I mean, it really wasn't their fault. They kind of had to, because the people who are in the hedge funds were making so much money. And if we've learned anything about Wall Street, it's that they don't really create anything. It's a talent business. And as we learned when everything started blowing up, Wall Street was making all its money taking risks and having these people take risks. So if they lose the people who are best at taking risk, they lose their profits. And so they had to start paying hedge fund. It was the hedge fund compensation system that drove the crazy pay at banks, and that drove a lot of the destructive behavior.
But we're still seeing it.
And we're still seeing it.
Why bonuses today, considering the current situation?
It is mind-boggling. It is mind-boggling, but there is a pressure. Wall Street has to make their numbers. They need the people who take the risk with other people's money, or the prop trading that we've heard a lot about with the Volcker Rule and whatnot being discussed. And thus, they need to pay those people to prevent them from jumping to hedge funds. So nothing has really changed.
You write a lot about being an outsider, wearing tattered suits and driving a beat-up Subaru while everyone around you was dressed expensively and drove Maybachs. What was that like? Did they treat you like you were a poor cousin?
At first, yes. At first, they were like, you know, who is this guy? And with him and his magazines. But as we became part of the Wall Street culture and the global financial culture, I started getting accepted, and you know, I think I used the term in the book, Jane Goodall with some cool magazines at first, and then the gorillas kind of let me into the tribe. I still, you know, what they didn't know, they all assumed, which is funny in their world, because I was kind of seen as a peer in their world, they just assumed that I made their kind of money. They didn't know that every liquid dollar I had, I poured back into the company, and that I basically, in terms of having cash, was broke.
But you also could have gotten some inside information and made a couple of bucks on the market.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't actually money actually that drove this entire thing. It was, but I did absolutely get caught up in it. But it was more that we were building something that was attracting a lot of attention. There was an addiction for me too, but it really, it was less about the money because I've never been money driven, but you know, I wanted something successful. I wanted a legacy, but it was based on a lot of very, very false morals.
And you call the second section of your book Mania.
Yeah.
And that's what you say drove the years directly before the collapse, 2006 to 2008?
It was more than just a Wall Street mania. I think our entire culture drank the Kool-Aid. And if you saw, and that's where people started buying, leveraging their house to buy a second house. That's where you started seeing regular people try to emulate Main Street and try to emulate Wall Street. And that's where it got really interesting for us, because we were kind of this accessible media company that had access to all the greatest financial people. And so we started having all sorts of people, regular people, companies, famous people, celebrities, come to us as kind of the nexus between Main Street and Wall Street. And all of a sudden we found ourselves doing these absolutely bizarre, ridiculous, crazy, but you know, great book material. But we were the conduit for a lot of regular people to try to get a piece of that Wall Street riches. It wasn't that people were repelled by it. People during this mania period, people were not repelled by Wall Street. Wall Street people, the Steve Schwartzmans of the world and the John Paulson, they were almost folk heroes, and we were a way to get at them.
Although there are some people you write about here who are not Wall Streeters. You decided to feature John Travolta on the cover of the first issue of another one of your magazines, Private Air.
Yep. And that was – he was thrilled because here's somebody – we saw a lot of that. I mean, we dealt with so many celebrities who wanted – they loved the idea. It's always been the case that kind of people with money always wanted to be associated with celebrity. And that's why a lot of people buy sports teams or buy record labels or whatnot. What we saw during the zeros was that the celebrities wanted to hang out with the Wall Streeters. And that was a complete flip. And so you had John Travolta, who led us into – he showed us his personal photo records. He wanted everyone to know that here's a guy who owns two jets. I mean, John Travolta lives in a housing development in Florida where the driveway is a runway. And he could fly. He's got a converted Qantas, I think it's a 727, that he lands on a runway and taxis it up to his house. I mean, the scale of wealth and excess was unbelievable. This is somebody who was thrilled to be on the cover of – because he could be on the cover of Entertainment Weekly or Us Weekly anytime he wants. To be on the cover of a private plane magazine, that was exciting for him.
Although he gave you a hard time.
He gave us a very hard time because he had hair issues. We took pictures of him.
He should have called it private hair.
I'm not sure he has any hair, given what we kind of picked up from negotiating with him. He didn't like how his hair looked, and we had it almost killed the first issue because we'd given him the right to approve the cover, which a lot of celebrity magazines do. We'd never done that before, but we never had a John Travolta stepping forward and saying, I want to be on the cover of your magazine. But then he chose to veto every issue because he didn't like how his hair looked. There was some question about whether it was really his hair.
My guest is Randall Lane, whose book, The Zeros, My Misadventures in the Decade Wall Street Went Insane, is published by Portfolio. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You describe many of the traders as being all too happy to profit off of tragedy. Was that common? For example, you opened the book with a story of a trader making a lot of money, what is it, $1.5 million on September 11th.
Yeah, in 30 minutes on September 11th, where, you know, all of us here in New York, and, you know, I live about 30 blocks from Ground Zero, so we all understand that. But it's just, it's not, and I'm not necessarily passing judgment, although you can only look at the results and it gets you very sick to your stomach. But it's just the way they're built, where they look at the world events, and to them, these are opportunities. These are trading opportunities. So while all of us were watching mouths agape as the towers are burning and about to fall, the trader, you know, he got a nickname for being incredibly brave, Braveheart. He went in and he bought every European bond he could find because his mind immediately got the idea that that people were going to want safety, that meant bonds, and people are going to want to maybe flee America until they know what's going on. So that's Europe. And it was a brilliant, and he bet everything he had, and he borrowed and borrowed and bet, and he made $1.5 million, a 24-year-old kid, in 30 minutes.
And I'm sure that a lot of people made money from Hurricane Katrina and have made a lot of money from the BP disaster.
You know, we detail one trader here on the NYMEX here in New York who made $20 million on oil futures during Katrina. Same idea, looking at this and not seeing the chance that New Orleans might be wiped out, but seeing the probability that natural gas prices are going to go up.
Did you ever feel guilty that your magazines were helping perpetuate the culture of wealth and greed that eventually led to the meltdown?
I you know, felt and feel very guilty. But at the time, no, because I think like too many people, and, you know, again, I'll raise my hand on this, it didn't feel at the time. I mean, we definitely on some of the stuff, and we wrote about it. Some of the stuff like Hurricane Katrina, you have to raise your eyebrows, and we called that out, and we traders would complain when we called it out. But by and large, the broader point, what we everybody saw Wall Street as the engine of growth during most of the decade. So in some ways, I was excited because here we were covering what seemed to be the most exciting, most vibrant piece of the American economy until kind of we discovered along with everybody, and we should have been early on this, but we were caught up in the mania that it was all a house of cards.
Now, there's still a lot of money out there. Why did your magazines collapse?
Our magazines collapsed for several reasons. One, we were in mega growth mode, like too many people who were over leveraged, and we had credit lines, and we were building to try to make a giant $100 million media empire as opposed to just trying to conserve our pennies and grow incrementally. So we fell victim to the mindset. But more important, there is no way that a company associated with Wall Street excess and spending was going to make it through 2009. And the moment that I knew we were in real trouble, because even after the AIG Lehman party and people are acting a little different, we just thought, okay, we'll come back in 2009. We'll be fine. I mean, we had $12 million in revenue in 2008. I mean, we were a small but very fast-growing company. And there was never any question in our mind that we were going to survive. It was just how big were we going to make it. But then all of a sudden something clicked where not only were our advertising base, was it kind of flat and plateauing, but then people started pulling their advertising, not because we weren't effective. And we had one advertiser, BMW, where we had a party and we sold four cars right at the party. Nobody does that in media. And we knew that. BMW knew that. And they advertised, you know, major, major advertising package with us, probably $500,000. And they pulled their advertising and we're like, why are you pulling? We're the best thing you guys have. And they said, we know, but we cannot be seen advertising to those guys right now. They were seen as the absolute villains, and to some degree that was true. So we had no chance because people, even if we worked, didn't want to be at touch Wall Street. It was a four-letter word with a six-letter word attached to it.
You name a lot of names here, not just John Travolta, but Jim Cramer, Lenny Dykstra, Peter Max is really upset with the excerpt from the book that appeared in Vanity Fair. You weren't worried that you were burning bridges?
I made a decision when I wrote this, and it really wasn't about burning bridges. It was about telling an honest story about this entire run we had, because what I saw, really was a metaphor for a lot of things. And to be able to, you know, I'm a journalist by training, and to have a journalist who just happened, you know, I never intended to write a book, but it was only after everything fell, and I looked back and could take my journalism skills and realize that, wow, what I witnessed was, as the subtitle says, was truly insane. And to tell a book that kind of captures an era that people will be talking about for 50, 100 years. And I said, you know, I'm not trying to burn bridges, and I was not trying to take unfair pokes at people. But in the Peter Max story, for example, I mean, that was some craziness where we had Peter Max, you know, Peter Max was painting portraits of hedge fund titans, you know, as part of an idea he had to sell it back to them and give us a big cut of it. So we were part of it. But it was all just part of this crazy, crazy world that hopefully won't be back for a while. But
well, that's the way he makes a living. I've actually, I find Peter Max one of the nicer people I've met. But still, sure. That's the way he makes a living as an artist. I understand. Have you been able to maintain any of the relationships you established during the period when you were riding high?
A lot. I think a lot of people. I re-interviewed about 50 people in filling out my memory for this book, and I had access to 43,000 emails that I'd received and 20,000 that I'd sent. So I had this incredible database to sort through to really put everything, you know, with specificity. But then I re-interviewed 50 people, and a lot of people are reflecting right now. I mean, it really is a time for reflection and just kind of taking stock of what we just went through.
Just one more thing. What did Lenny Dykstra tell you regarding steroid use in Major League Baseball?
Lenny Dykstra and I had a very interesting night. We were helping Lenny Dykstra put out Lenny Dykstra wanted a piece of this too, and we helped him develop a magazine for pro athletes. He hired us to. He wanted to be the financial guru for pro athletes. And at one point, Lenny Dykstra, Ron Darling from the Mets, and myself were at AIG of all places, where Lenny was pitching this idea of kind of creating these crazy pro athlete derivatives for pro athlete retirement. And AIG was coming up with these great plans. We're going to sell $9 billion worth of these. And Lenny, you're going to make $700 million yourself. I mean, and again, that didn't seem that crazy as it does now. You just can laugh at it. And that's a lot of the stories that we tell in this book, that at the time they were normal. In retrospect, they were just delicious, ironic, sad. It's like a tragic comedy. But with Lenny, we became friends. And there was one night, February 13th, 2008, where I was at his hotel room, and I was trying to get him to pay us what he owed us, which was always difficult with Lenny. And it just so happened that Roger Clemens testified that day about his steroid use on Capitol Hill. And it was on infinite loop on CNN. And for 4 hours, I'm sitting there with him, because Lenny's a very good filibuster. And when he doesn't want to do something, he'll just make you wait and wait and wait. And we're watching this, and it's very awkward. And I'd say in the book, it's kind of like watching, you know, the World at War marathon with your SS grandfather. And because, you know, Lenny was implicated in the Mitchell Report, but he'd always denied it. And finally, he kind of steps back, and it's almost like he wanted to unburden himself. And he kind of had a crooked smile come across his face. And he said, you know, me and Jose Canseco, we were the pioneer. We were the first. He was like, Clemens is nothing. Me and Canseco did that before anybody, and explained how he did it.
People will find anything to brag about. Randall Lane's book, The Zeros, My Misadventures in the Decade That Wall Street Went Insane. It's published by Portfolio, which is a division of Penguin. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Leonard.